UFO conference. This is Timothy Good, and he comes to us all the way from England, but we're not doing it on from England tonight because he's here to talk. But it's Timothy Good. Let's say hello to everybody.
Good evening. Hi, everybody.
Okay. And I told him, we'll be talking for a whole hour here. I've known Timothy for many years now. He's been coming to this conference regularly as a regular speaker because he has many books out, and you're really in demand everywhere to speak, aren't you?
Well, sometimes, yes.
I know that's when I see you when you come to the States, anyhow.
Right.
All right. Well, I want Timothy to tell us a little bit about himself and how he got into all of this.
Well, you know, Dolores, it goes back to 1955, that's right. That's
long way back.
52 years ago. And I've always been mad about aircraft and space travel.
Uh-huh.
So when an American cousin, a guy called Edmund C. Berkeley, who actually was editor of the first magazine on computers in the United States in the 1940s, it was called Computers and Automation.
Uh-huh.
He presented me with this book by Donald Kehoe, The Flying Saucers of the Real.
Oh, I remember that's one of the beginning, wasn't it?
Absolutely. This was in 1955, and he said, Timothy, you like airplanes and space travel? You need to know about flying saucers. So that's how my interest began. And then when I read how many military and civilian pilots were seeing these things,
uh-huh.
and that they were being confirmed on radar by air traffic controllers and others, I got hooked completely. This wasn't science fiction. I mean, the cover of the book, I remember, a very sort of garish cover.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like something out of, I don't know, one of the sort of pulp.
But you know, even in those early days, they were trying to discredit all of it.
They were, and it's interesting that Kehoe was the first to expose the cover-up, because he had very high-level contacts in the Pentagon and CIA and Air Force Intelligence, for example. And, the cover-up is proven. There's absolutely no question about it. I'm surprised anybody has the slightest doubts about it. I mean, I find it very puzzling.
Me too, because, you know, we're so much into this that we know it exists. There's no way you can say it doesn't. That's why when it comes to these conferences, like they're preaching to the choir, because we already know it all about everything that's going on. But in the 50s, you must have been pretty young then when you had your interest first.
I was, yes. I was about 13, 14 years old, something like that at that time.
Very vulnerable age, and that's when it hits you then.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've not looked back. And then in 1961, I bought the report on unidentified flying objects by Captain Ed Ruppelt, who headed Air Force's second or third, actually, third and final project, known as Project Blue Book. He was Air Force Intelligence Officer, a very good man. He's still a hero of mine, like Kehoe, and he wrote that book. It was really, really quite extraordinary, even by today's standards, the amount of information he was able to come out with.
You know, in our very first conference we ever had here 20 years ago, it was before Lou took it on, Bill Pitts did the first one, and we only had like not even 50 people here.
Right.
And we had these experts from Washington, the ones that were involved with the Blue Book Project and the Project Grudge from the very beginning. And one thing we liked about it is this gave us our background, so we would know the background of the whole UFO phenomenon.
Right.
So I know what you're talking about. These were people that came from Washington and gave what they knew. But a lot of them still were denying.
Well, of course.
You know, but then that's when somebody in the audience said, oh, yeah, you'll lose your pension if you say it's real.
Yeah.
So I know who you're talking about. This is the very early days.
Absolutely. And really, nothing much has changed. In fact, it's astonishing how much information did get out. I mean, one of the guys today was saying, I mean, there was tons of stuff getting out, and it really had to be shut down. I mean, I think the CIA and the Air Force Intelligence and the other people, this had become a national security matter. They had to sit on it.
So they said they had a great deal coming out in those early days. And
Terry Hansen, who was the last speaker
just
before our break here, I mean, he's terrific. I have the highest admiration for him, and I told Lou Farish, the organizer of the conference, to get him at all costs, and he's absolutely wonderful.
Uh-huh.
And he's written a book called The Missing Times,
which
he is a professional reporter, uh-huh. you know, with degrees in journalism and so forth, and he's exposed all sorts of tricks that are used by the media, because the media literally is controlled.
Oh, it is, definitely. I know that.
So, and I'm sure many of your listeners are aware of that.
You know, one thing that I always tell people, I travel a lot, and I go to Europe a lot. In Europe, you're going to get the real news. You come back here, and you don't hear it.
Well, I'm afraid to say that
it's also
global.
Censored over there, too, then.
It's global. If something really sensitive gets out, it will either be debunked or whatever.
But really, you have more better news than we have here in England, because when I go there and I hear
Probably.
Something, I come back and I'll ask my kids, did you hear about us and such? They said, no, there's nothing on the news about it.
That's
there definitely is censored, even in the smallest things.
Yes, I know some friends of mine who listen regularly to Russian international news in English and Chinese.
You're getting more and closer to the truth?
And, well, I think probably a blend of all news agencies might get you somewhere close to the truth of, say, something sensitive like what's going on in Iraq right now.
Yeah,
you know?
What is the truth, you know, and how we never know how much we're being allowed to know anyhow.
No, it's all manipulated in the interest of national security, and they have to do that. They always have
to. Well, we can understand that in a way, too.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is what you were doing, talking about the Blue Book.
Mm-hmm.
Project, and you got involved with that I just read about it,
that's
uh-huh.
all, yes. Later I met quite a number of people who were working for Blue Book
mm-hmm.
And other organizations, like CIA, for example, who had been investigating the subject and debunking it, particularly debunking it, mm-hmm. which they had to do.
But you were still young in those days, too.
Yes, well, I mean, I really started researching this seriously in about 1961 after reading the Repelt book, and then I'm also a professional violinist. So.
I was going to ask you, what do you do for a living? That's
well,
quite a contrast.
Well, actually, I mean,
I know
as
you
an
are,
author.
I know I mean, you as a writer, but I didn't.
As a writer, there have been periods when I've earned, you know, quite a lot of money at it, but you cannot make a living. I haven't been able to make a living at it exclusively for a long time.
That's
I don't
right.
know anybody else who
no,
does
that's
either.
Why I try to tell people. I lecture at writers' conferences,
right.
and they think you write a book, you're going to get rich. And
I know.
If you want to get to make money, don't write.
No.
It gives you satisfaction
in
some money, but it's not. You can't make a living at it.
No, and I try to explain to people, okay, you know, they look on my website, timothygood.com. co.uk, by the way.
Yeah, we're going to give it out a couple more times.
And, you know, they see best-selling author. And I did have several best-selling books. Now, there are best-selling books and best-selling books, Dolores. I don't need to explain to you, but I think the listeners would be interested.
Yeah, go ahead.
You need to be on a best-selling book list for a very long time before you become a millionaire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the longest I've been on is 13 weeks. It was good. I got good money out
mm-hmm.
of it. But if I'd been on like Stephen Hawking, you know, The Brief History of Time, I mean, he was like 4 years.
Oh,
I mean, he's a millionaire.
There's not very much like that.
So people don't understand that, but now they do, of course, at least your listeners do. So.
Well, you know, too, they don't realize the books don't stay out there that long.
No, shelf life is
short. And a lot of them, what I try to tell the writers coming up, it's like a magazine. It's only going to be out for so many. The copies are sold, or what they think is sold, then they pull the book.
Yeah.
So that's all the time you have, and it may be a matter of months, and then the book is gone.
Yeah. So anyway, as a violinist, I started my career after leaving the Royal Academy of Music with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, and I toured the United States and Canada
in
1963.
You were trained in England?
Yes,
in London.
The Royal Academy of Music was the last training place I went to. And then I did I think it was 11 or 12 week tour of the States and Canada.
This is a surprise.
Including
I didn't know this side of you.
And interestingly, I was in Dallas, I think about a week before the dreadful assassination of President Kennedy.
63, 63.
And I remember that day very, very, they say everyone remembers. I was.
They all know where you were on that
day. I was in Fresno, California. And there was this big debate with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra then as to whether we should play or not. In fact, we did play, and there were people really giving us a hard time about it. Others say, I'm glad you did.
Mm.
But we had to change some of the music, you know, to play some sort of sad funereal
thing.
And then I joined the London Symphony Orchestra in 1964, and I was with them for 14 years.
That's quite an
accomplishment. Obviously, these were sort of world tours and things, so I did a lot of UFO research.
Oh, when you were traveling with the orchestras, then you were able to.
Yeah.
It's quite an accomplishment, though, to be with the orchestras for that long.
Yes, and I'm still playing. I'm still doing mostly concerts. After the symphony orchestras, because I played with quite a few, including the Mantovani Orchestra, which I did 20 years in what we call the commercial scene, which is doing backing for pop groups, and pop singers, and television commercials, radio commercials, and, of course, film scores. So I've taken a lot of films.
See, I went that route, too.
Really?
When I was younger, but I was a singer.
Oh.
And I did the concerts and the light opera and all of that, so I know what you mean.
Right.
We had the orchestras that played and the big symphony halls, and
yeah.
I loved it. I loved the symphony, and I loved the classics.
Yes.
But then, you know, we all, I don't know, maybe you think it's because it is going along with the creative. To be a writer it's, in music, it's all creative.
Absolutely.
Anyway.
I couldn't live without music.
The same way.
I think it's absolutely
not good. The music nowadays.
No, well, it depends, but you know, really great music. I think is has a healing.
But I went the other way and became a writer too. But I still enjoy the classics. But maybe it is something to do with the creative part of the mind that leads us into writing also. With your indie music,
could be. I never
or art.
I didn't imagine until around 1980. I think it was, that I would ever write a book on the UFO. And my first book was self-published with a lady called Lou Zinstark, who was a co-worker of the famous UFO contactee, George Adamski.
Oh,
she knew him very, very well. She accompanied him together with a Belgian lady to the Vatican in 1963 when Adamski had a private audience with the Pope.
So they didn't think he was crazy.
The Pope certainly did. I mean, he did actually, he was able to prove that he had this meeting shortly before the Pope died. I mean, you know, like 2-3 days before the Pope died.
But I remember the controversy around
tremendous controversy. But he did see the Pope and pass a message which had been, in turn, given to him by his space contact.
Ah, so he was able to do that.
And having myself had experiences with beings that I'm convinced were from elsewhere.
When did that happen? About the same time?
Oh, gosh.
Or what?
Interestingly, yes. The first one was in 1963.
Uh-huh.
And we were on that tour I was mentioning with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yeah.
And it was on a trip from, where was it? I think it was Phoenix or Tucson. I think it was Tucson.
It's hard to remember.
To Los Angeles. All I know is that I remember it's 512 miles, and we were in a convoy of like 3 Greyhound-type buses that had been chartered, you know, and they were very kind. On that 512-mile ride, we had a one-hour stop, which, you know, so we managed to... And my first encounter took place in a restaurant when I saw a most extraordinary-looking girl waiting in line.
So it wasn't a sighting, it was an actual
being,
a person, a being.
Absolutely.
In the restaurant.
In the restaurant, waiting in line. Mm-hmm. She was with someone else. Now, people say, Tim, you know, you just saw a pretty girl, you've had to do anything. Well, she was pretty, but it was more her general demeanor.
Yeah.
She was quite petite. She had very pale, delicate skin, the sort of skin, you know, when you can see sort of blue veins showing through at the
translucent.
Side. Translucent, exactly. Mm-hmm. But there was a remarkably alert quality about her, which it almost hit me. And I went back there, and I was alerted. And I already knew at that time.
What about the eyes? Were the eyes different?
I can't remember. I've since had two other experiences where I can remember a great deal
about
more
something
detail.
About the eyes,
the eyes
being intense or something.
But I can't remember her eyes very well, I have to tell you, but...
You think it's mostly her her demeanor?
Yes, and the description matched one of Adamski's descriptions of one of the ladies on board.
That he met out in the desert that time.
Well, up in the craft, actually.
Okay.
I mean, he met men and women, you know, from elsewhere who were on the large motherships. And, or it may have been some influence from her, I don't know. But Anyway, I sent out a mental thought telepathy. I said, if you're from another planet, is there some way you can prove this to me?
Uh-huh.
So there was no immediate response. I mean, she had a... All these guys I've seen, the three in my lifetime, it's not as if I'm seeing them every week, you know. I mean, three experiences in my life.
Yeah.
She came out of line with this deadpan expression. I was with three other colleagues sitting at the table. We got our food. And she did a fantastic low bow like that.
Right to you?
Right in front of me like that. And smiled with a sweet smile. And then deadpan face walked off.
Hmm.
And that was that. Never saw her again.
Now, thinking logically, do you think she could have recognized you from being with the orchestra? Or you don't think it had anything to do with that? The scene you perform?
Why me? You know,
I don't know. Just being logical.
70, 80 guys in that, on that trip. You know,
okay.
And we were at the table together.
Hmm.
I think the others... I can't. I can't remember exactly who was with me, but I wish the others, could remember it because they were.
But you did send out a mental message.
I had, and it was granted. And then in 1967, I was with the London Symphony Orchestra giving a series of concerts at Carnegie Hall with the great cellist Rostropovich.
Mm.
And I was in what was then called the Park Sheraton Hotel, which is, I think, 57th and 8th or 7th Street, something like that. And it was very close to Carnegie.
Mm.
And I had spent some time, a few days previously, there'd been a few days off, I'd gone to Washington, specifically to Silver Spring, to meet my friend Madeline Rodefer, who was with Adamski when he took this remarkable color movie film of A Craft over Silver Spring, Maryland on February 26th of 1965.
I've not seen it. I've only seen still pictures.
Still pictures are better, actually, because the film actually was, Madeline hadn't realized at the time, that was in it, was for artificial light, like the taking inside rooms for parties and things, you know, with a professional flashlight and stuff.
Okay.
And anyway, it came out pretty well, but work had to be done by a guy called Bill Sherwood, who was an optical physicist, senior project engineer of Kodak, to get some fantastic prints, color prints as well, which I'd reproduced in quite a number of my books, actually. And that's a whole long story. There were about four or five people there actually present when that happened, including United States government people who were apparently in some kind of obligation, which is another whole can of worms we can maybe
and
talk
I would
about.
Say, do you want to open those can of worms, you know?
Right, but anyway.
This is when the second contact...
this is when the second... I had said to Madeline, because she'd had several encounters during the time Adamski was staying with her. He lived and died, actually. He died in not long after taking that film.
Mm.
He was not very well.
His job was over, I guess.
I believe so. And I think that air display, if you like, of that craft over Mrs. Rodefer's front lawn was a way of saying goodbye in a way, you know. But anyway, Madeline herself, if anyone wants to talk to her about this or anything, she's a telephone lady. She can't, she's very arthritic and she can't, unfortunately, write letters easily. But if anyone wants to talk to her about
She must be about pretty old by now, though.
She's about 83, I think.
Okay.
And anyway, she had these meetings with people.
Mm-hmm.
George sometimes introduced her to people working in Washington who were liaising with some of our government people, sometimes top secret assignments and things.
Mm.
And I said, well, how do I get to meet these people? She said, well, you had an experience 2 years ago, you know, why don't you try again? Why don't you just, you know, send out thoughts when you're back in New York?
Well, we
any of you guys are up.
So
I sat in the hotel lobby of Park Sheraton Hotel in New York City in the afternoon. I not recorded the date, she's unlike me, but it was in February of 1967. And I sat back in the settee and I sent out thoughts, if there are any of you guys in the New York area, please come and sit down next to me and prove it.
Okay.
So I then sat back and relaxed. Well, various people came and went. You have to be careful in the hotel lobby, you know. It's a very strange individual. Sometimes
well, I know. Believe
walk
me.
Off the street. Anyway, finally, this chap comes in, and as you Americans would say, he looked like he was straight out of Madison Avenue. I mean, he was.
Oh, the
do they still use that expression? I bet that's.
Yeah, I know what
I'm,
you mean.
I'm terribly out of place.
It means, you know, the really dressed, the suit and the tie and all of that. You mean
he was immaculate?
Yeah, immaculate.
It was a charcoal gray suit, white shirt. I remember the white shirt, dark tie. I couldn't tell you what color. It may have been even. It certainly wasn't black, but it was dark navy.
Like
or
a very successful businessman.
He had very nice wavy hair. He was. He looked tanned. That was the natural color.
Mm-hmm.
Bluish green eyes. He looked very serious. Extremely intelligent. He had glasses on. I remember that very well. But very fine features and everything. Anyway, he came and sat down next to me. Now, you can imagine there's me sitting on the right side looking out of this
somebody.
And this guy comes and sits in the middle of the sofa next to me.
Yeah.
All right.
He's a little strange on himself. Yeah.
Well, not really, but he did that. Okay. And then everything he did was kind of slow and deliberate. He had an attaché case. Unzipped the attaché case and took out the New York Times, unfolded it slowly, went through the pages just like this. I'm demonstrating.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like a few seconds on each page. Folded it all slowly and deliberately, put it back in the attaché case, closed the attaché case, put the attaché case on his lap here, and then just sat like that. So, in my mind, I said, right, if you're the guy I'm looking for, would you take your right index finger and hold it to the right side of your nose and keep it there? And instantly, he did just that.
Oh.
And he kept it there.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so I'm thinking, wow, you know, I'm going to get the secrets of the universe. what should I do now? He's going to talk to me, isn't he?
You would think so.
There was nothing. There was no more telepathic response. He just sat there.
Uh-huh.
I would say it could have been 10 minutes, it could have been 20 minutes, I don't know. I didn't time it.
Mm-hmm.
But then he got up and he just looked at me for quite a while in a very serious, kindly manner.
Yeah.
Not stern, not smiling. And then he walked and he looked into one of the display cabinets in the hotel lobby, and then he went out into the street. And I never saw him again, but I'd recognize him if I saw him again.
Mm.
So that was.
It was like it's a response. But yet he looked different than the woman. With the
yes. Yes. Well, you know, we're all different.
But what I've heard too, that a lot of times it's what I call a screen memory, where they can appear any way they want to appear, and it's not really the way they look in their normal state.
I think that might be true, but in this case, I am absolutely confident that this man was highly advanced of the species that probably produced Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
I'm convinced that we are a hybridized species.
Oh, yes, I've written about this, so I believe
it. Sure you have. What haven't you written?
But no, I definitely believe
it. My feeling, and we can get to talk about my latest book
shortly. But you know what I've been told, too, is they do live among us,
yes.
And they're able to exist because they have their organs have changed to where they can adapt to any kind of of an environment, they can adapt to any kind of gas in the air.
I think that depends on a number of things. I know that some of them need to get sort of re-acclimatized in their craft regularly.
And a lot of them live off of light in their craft. That's what I found, anyway.
I wouldn't know. I have no idea.
But they can appear human, and they said a lot of people would think they were human, but inside they're not really. But
I think they are.
I'm thinking maybe they've evolved. Well,
that depends. I mean, you know, the universe is kind of big.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of possibilities. But in my latest book, I've now come out at the end with a theory that I've long really subscribed to, and that is that we, Homo sapiens, are not the first race on planet Earth.
No, we're not.
Been pre-populated by other civilizations. You call it Lemuria, Atlantia, whatever.
Oh, yes. See, I've written on that going all the way back to the beginning.
And I've read a very interesting book on Lemuria, which I actually have cited in some of my previous books.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm convinced that the people who are living on this planet, maybe
millions of years before us.
Yes.
Hundreds of thousands of years.
Because in my work, yes. I've gone back to the beginning, so I know.
Right.
And there were many, many civilizations that went down. Atlantis was not the only one.
Right.
There were many of them that went down.
Okay. And they upgraded us at some point. I'm told at Homo erectus stage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we are a byproduct.
Yeah, we are.
And I furthermore think, you know, I wrote a book called Alien Base about sort of underwater and underground bases. And in my last book, Unearthly Disclosure, I wrote about a lot more about that from very reliable sources.
And I've written about that too, and I believe these things are real.
I'm talking about government sources.
But there is government bases also that are underground.
I agree, and I think there is a degree of liaison with a very restricted few in the scientific and military intelligence communities. But the point is, I think that a lot of these beings, when we see their craft, they're not necessarily coming from Alpha Centauri or Beta Reticuli or wherever, which wouldn't make any difference because their travel is apparently almost instantaneous.
I know, they go through dimensions immediately.
Sure. I think they can manipulate space-time.
They can. They do it by adjusting the vibration and frequency of a craft, so they can instantly go from one dimension to the next.
I wouldn't be surprised in the same way that master yogis can go through walls by...
Yes, that's how they do it, by changing the molecules of the body.
But so it's always occurred to me that these areas, like the Bermuda Triangle,
mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced that the guys in these places are all that friendly, I really have to say, because thousands of people have disappeared, as you know.
I have another story I've written about that, but I don't want to talk about mine, I want to talk about yours.
Okay, but the fact of the matter is that aircraft, and not just Bermuda Triangle, there's the Great Lakes, which in the 1980s, there were proportionately more aircraft and ships lost than in the Bermuda Triangle.
Mm.
In the same period.
But I think what you're talking about is that many of them do come in and out of the water and from underground.
Yes.
Because they have been seen going in and into
cool
lakes.
I think they're either they're extraterrestrial advanced races or they liaise with extraterrestrial. I mean, we don't know what the extent of their liaison with other races is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you probably know, but I haven't.
They do have bases underground.
I think I've been told that some of them are very, very, very large areas. Like there are two large bases in the Pacific Ocean, which I wasn't given specific locations, but I've got a darn good idea.
And there's also some huge bases in the outback in Australia, too.
I've heard about that. I was in Australia last year, and there was a presentation by a guy who's done some research into.
I've been back to a little town. I was invited to come there, and I write about it, but I never wanted to give the name out because it's just a very small town. You go there, you think you're in the Old West. That's how old-fashioned it is. But they said there's like an alleyway, they call it, over that town, but there's constant UFO activity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like there's a vortex there in a portal.
That's right. Yes, I heard.
The woman there, 90-year-old woman, was the historian and has been keeping records for many, many years of all the sightings and everything going in and out of there. So I believe this. You know, they would be back out there where nobody would see them.
There are many other areas around the world. The Devil's Sea off Japan, I think, is another one. The Bass Strait in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Between Tasmania and Melbourne. I mean, a lot of stuff's got on off there, disappearing, young pilots disappearing and so forth. And
but see, you know,
Brazil, all sorts of areas.
We know these things. It bothers me when somebody comes up who's a beginner and they're taking their first baby steps and are asking these very simple questions. Do you mean you believe UFOs exist? I've been investigating this for 20 years, and we know. Mm-hmm. We know it exists.
Yes.
And you don't have to prove it to us, but there's a lot of people out there who don't have the inkling of how important all of this is.
Right.
How advanced it really is.
Yes.
Let me go back for a minute. You said the first book you ever wrote, you was self-published.
Called George Adamski, The Untold Story, and Lou, short for Louise Zinstag, who was a second cousin of Jung, the great
psychologist,
by the way, and she had conversations with him about the subject on many occasions. He was very interested. And, of course, his last book, Jung's last book, was called Flying Saucers.
He did believe in it then.
What he wrote in the book is that, yes, there are psychological reasons why people are seeing the mandala symbol all sorts of other things. But he said the fact of the matter is that these things are not just verified by human beings. They're verified by sophisticated radar systems, mm-hmm. which means they must be solid.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they exist. He said, UFOs per se exist, but it's not my job. I'm a psychologist. And
but at least
he said
he
they were real.
Something he can't debunk
yes.
anyway.
Yes.
But then that was the first book.
That was my first book, and
did
we
sell?
Made it. We divided. It did. It sold out. I did everything. I did all the promotion, and I did going around all the bookshops around the UK. It's amazing. The first shop I went in to sell it was Harrods, and they said, "Sure, we'll buy 6 copies." I'm sure you did the same.
Oh yeah, I've beat the bushes. I've done the whole thing. I know what you mean.
But it was fun. I learned a lot about the business. And
it's not easy. There again, people think they can go out and make money doing this, and it's. A lot of times, we call it, you have to take money out of your own pocket to do it.
Right. Oh,
because
yeah.
they don't
oh.
pay you to come and lecture they, in the beginning. And
yeah.
You're trying to sell the book. All you care about is making a little money off of it, maybe to pay for your travel.
I'll never forget, I was trying to do sort of like 33% discount, or whatever it is, 33.5%.
Yeah.
You know, that used to be quite common back gosh, when did that book come out? 1983.
Mm-hmm.
But very shortly, you know, the big chain stores like W.H. Smith.
You can't get into any of that. A self-publisher can't do it.
50%, got to be 50%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the self-publishers can't get into those anymore.
No.
But then how was you picked up from that by another publisher or what?
Well, what happened was I then wrote Above Top Secret. I suppose that's, in a way, my most famous book.
These are what you've been gathering this information in all your travels?
I had, yes. Years and years, and that was published in 1987 with a foreword by Lord Hill Norton, the Chief of Defense Staff, and
you said you traveled all over the world with your music, and you were doing
this stuff.
Research in the meantime.
I wrote that book, and it was a bestseller. I think it was the number one bestseller in Australia, at any rate.
Uh-huh.
It was doing very well, but then it was published in the U.S. the following year. I did pretty well.
Why do you think they believed you so much? Do you think it's because of your reputation?
First of all, let me tell you, that book had about 30 rejections.
I've been there.
You've been
there. I've been there. I know.
And we all have to go through that. It's quite common.
It took me nine years to find my first book.
It wasn't until an agent, a literary agent, said, I understand you've written a book, blah, blah, blah. Why don't you join up with my agency? And of course, you do stand a better chance if you can get an agent.
Yeah, there's somebody who can get you in, anyway.
Yeah.
But, I know I've been there. It took 9 years to find my first publisher. I've got it going. So, but that's a lot of people think they're going to get it right off the bat. It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But then that book is what made your reputation then, wasn't it?
Yes. And then I followed with Alien Liaison.
But you're a very careful researcher, too.
I try to be.
That makes a difference.
I'm a fanatical researcher, getting my facts right.
That makes a difference.
Being objective about them.
Because you do something wrong, that destroys all of your validity
Absolutely.
To all your work.
Absolutely, yes. Sure.
I've always told you, you have to do your homework.
Yes.
And it shows if you don't do your homework.
Yeah.
One mistake and they discount everything.
Yeah.
So that's what they liked that about you, your research and your precision to detail, I guess.
I guess so, yeah.
Then the second book was Alien
Liaison,
mm-hmm.
which was well received. I think that was a bestseller, but a limited bestseller, as we discussed earlier.
Yeah.
I wasn't making millions by any means.
No, it just...
But
you get a reputation. That's why you can't do it with just one book.
No. Then I did Alien Base, which concentrated mostly on contacts with, you hear people talking about the greys and the talls and the blondes and the Nordics and now the reptilians. But quite frankly, there's far more different types of species have been seen over the years.
Many.
They're not necessarily all here at the same time, but passing through this particular neck of the woods. And some very, very bizarre beings that don't fit the sort of general idea.
Yeah, in my work, I've been told some of them, you wouldn't even think they were alive because they're so strange to our way of thinking.
Uh-huh.
But they are,
surprised.
They're living beings.
I wouldn't be at all surprised.
It's just like Star Trek and Star Wars, how they show all these different beings, and that's really the way it is.
Yep.
They come from many different places.
Yes.
But that book was mostly about the contact.
Yes, absolutely. And also actually, then I came out with Beyond Top Secret, which was the sequel to Above Top Secret. It was a lot more new information. It wasn't published in the States, unfortunately.
But how were you able to get access to these records?
I've got access to intelligence records. I mean, one of my specialities within the UFO subject is, of course, military intelligence aspects.
So they allow you to
enter topics? You've had a Freedom of Information Act since 1966, I think, and hundreds if not millions of documents relating to UFO material pages.
But the ones I've seen, they usually have it all blacked out, and a lot of it's very hard to get anything
out. No, a lot of them are very good. I mean, I have in my latest book, which we need to talk about.
I'm going to.
I'll hold back. I'll wait for your...
Okay, I was just wanting to get your background, but...
Okay.
Okay, now, but after these other ones, now this is the next one?
No, 1996 was Beyond Top Secret.
Yeah.
Then I produced in 2000 Unearthly Disclosure.
Okay.
Which was, again, mostly about the contacts and the different types of abductions and contacts and some extraordinary cases. Like I did six chapters on the creature. I reproduced color photographs of a creature taken in Italy, in the Abruzzi Mountains, by a guy called Filiberto
Capone. Is that like a Bigfoot, or is it a different kind of creature?
No, it's... I haven't got the pictures with me now, but... extraordinary creature, about 90 centimeters high, with very large eyes. It was obviously in trouble. It looked as if it had been burnt or something. We don't know. The arms were atrophied.
Hmm.
It was able to leap huge distances and made a shrieking sound. There was no communication.
Makes you wonder if maybe something happened and it got deserted or left here.
It does appear to be something like that. And on one famous occasion, when this witness was taking pictures with his Polaroid camera. He got Polaroid pictures, which are superb, some of them. His grandmother, who I met, came down. She had been terrified, and she stood by him. And she was, the way she talked about it, she was absolutely thrilled. And,
you have six chapters on that. On just that alone.
On that. And I hired a forensic analyst who had done a lot of work for the police in imagery. Video and particularly photographic imagery at crime scenes and bodies and things, so he was able to make a lot of intelligent assumptions that it wasn't fake.
It wasn't from here.
So that's an unearthly disclosure, and I'm amazed. I mean, I was in Washington the other day, and it was in Borders, in paperback. It's still there, unearthly disclosure.
Still
and it stayed around in the States, even though it wasn't published here.
Well, then how many books have you written altogether?
Well, I did also a total of four books that I edited, like yearbooks. You know, I would commission people, say, like Paul Dong, who's Chinese, to do a thing on the Chinese scene, someone from Russia, Nikolai Lebedev, who did a thing on all the latest developments in Russia. All over the world.
Uh-huh.
And they were very successful. The last one of those was published in this country. It's called Alien Update, and I think you might still. And then
but how many altogether have you written then?
I think it's 12. I think it's 12. 11 or 12.
Okay, I'm one up on you anyway.
Oh, thanks, brother.
Okay. But okay, now talk about the new one. You said this has come out in England.
Is Need to Know, and the subtitle is UFOs, the Military and Intelligence. I have never, ever worked on anything so hard in my life. It really strained me mentally because...
Why was it hard?
Well, partly because of the complexity of the book, also because I simply wasn't able to assimilate everything in the allotted time. I foolishly gave a very optimistic
timetable
delivery date.
I
could not do it, and they were saying you've got to get it done. So I was up sometimes starting work at 2 o'clock in the morning, and
but I would have thought
typically 6 in the morning I started, and it just went on, you know. I would get a break in the...
I thought with all of your books, you would, with nothing left that you could find. This is totally new information, then.
Not all of it, but a lot of it is totally new. Absolutely. I mean, I've gone back on some cases because I found out a lot of new information, and there's stunning, stunning material. I regard it as my most important book to date. Well, I have to say it myself. I'm sorry, but it is.
But don't we always think the book we're working on at the present time is always the most important?
I suppose, if I'm honest, yes.
I think writers feel that way.
Yes. But but there's a wealth of new documentary material in here, all sorts of things, right back from the early days, and thanks to a very helpful source, John Andy Kistner,
uh-huh.
who was a former state representative for New Mexico. So he represented Las Cruces, and he was also in the aerospace business. He's done a lot of research into some old things.
I think I've heard about him.
Yes, you would have done. He gave Linda some research material, and me,
uh-huh.
and Stan Friedman, and I've put a lot of that in books. He helped me a great deal. Wonderful. And this is information going back to the early days, starting in 1947 in May. Well, actually, the book goes back to the 1930s.
Okay.
Official.
That far back.
That far back. It's like the Italian government recovering apparently an alien vehicle and having a lot of sightings in the 1930s.
These are things we don't hear about.
But the most shocking thing to me that I discovered was that in May 1947, when Wernher von Braun's team started firing off the captured V-2 rockets,
mm-hmm.
the UFOs were really getting interested and humming and buzzing all over White Sands area,
mm-hmm.
and they actually knocked several rockets out of trajectory. So
uh-huh.
they passed. And this led the military to redouble its efforts to shoot these things down, because you remember, not long after Pearl Harbor in February 1432, 1,430 rounds of anti-aircraft shells
mm-hmm.
were fired at UFOs. None was knocked down.
I remember they talked about the Foo Fighters during the war.
That's another thing, and I've got details. These things weren't always just fuzzy, the Foo Fighters. They were sometimes very, very large. I've got
uh-huh.
details.
But each side thought they were secret weapons.
But the other, they did, absolutely. But what happened? The Americans started firing at them, and they actually succeeded in knocking several down. Almost certainly one of them, one of which, or two, became the Roswell incident. And they were not just shooting at them, they were using what's called proximity fuses with guided missiles, which explode when they get very close to the target.
Mm-hmm.
And they knocked some of these things
out.
So
they knocked them out without...
Some of them became very, very unstable. And the people, there are reports, I've got contemporary reports I've reproduced in the book, and aliens responded by knocking out hundreds, if not thousands, of our aircraft, including civilian airlines.
Mm.
This hasn't come out before.
No, that's never been reported.
And I've got some of the articles I've reproduced, the New York Times, President Truman orders urgent inquiry.
Mm.
Newspapers reported like 100 crashes in one day of things where planes couldn't get off the ground.
These are things that maybe they might appear one time and then you don't hear about them again.
Yeah.
So they want to hush
it up. This went on. And I've also got the Defense Department figures. For the American edition, anyway, which is coming out on June the 3rd.
We're going to talk about that, too.
There were, between 1952 and 1956, 18,600 crashes involving high-performance fighters of type that would be sent to chase UFOs.
That's a huge number.
Now, obviously, they weren't all due to UFOs.
No.
But 9.5%, that's something like, I think, 1,773, 1,773 were due to unknown causes, and that is the U.S. Defense Department statement.
Mm. Well, I've investigated UFO crashes that
we right.
don't hear about either.
Right.
And I tried to find somebody who might know something about them, but mm-hmm. I've had talked to the people who were there,
yes.
you know, who were in the service, and they were in helicopters and landed, and they thought it was airplane crashes,
right.
and it was
yes.
UFO crashes.
Yes.
So there's more than people. It was more
yes.
than Roswell. That
and
was
I've also named a very important witness, a guy who was known as Fritz Werner. That was his pseudonym. In 1953, at Kingman, Arizona, quite a famous case when
okay.
a flying saucer was picked up by the military. And this guy is revealed for the first time his real name. And I've reproduced a part of his CV, which is very, very impressive. And he was very.
But I can see why the government wouldn't want a lot of this to get out.
Well,
can you imagine? The
now I understand a great deal more. There's no way they could say, yeah, we've got aliens coming in, you know, knocking our
and
planes
shot
out.
All
of the
these plans, planes down.
I mean,
they wouldn't understand that.
There was, and there still is, a conflict situation, unfortunately, with some of these species. I'm told some of them are dangerous. Also, I've got stuff right up to O'Hare. Extraordinary incident in November the 7th of last year. That will be in the American
edition. How could they possibly deny that? It was right there, but they were saying it couldn't be. These are people who see the flights all the time. They knew it was neither than a UFO.
Absolutely. And but more and more people, have you noticed, have come forward showing little short video clips. And,
yeah, and nowadays you can do it on your
mobile. Yeah, the pictures aren't very good, but I mean, what I've seen, absolutely, they were there, and other witnesses have come forward. And they've all been...
There's a lot more going on than people believe.
Yes.
But this book is called Need to Know,
yes.
And it came out in England.
UFOs, the most, it came out in England in hardback edition in August of last year, but it'll be June the 1st, published by Pegasus Books.
In America.
New York. Pegasus Books, New York, and that's www.pegasusbooks.com.
And it'll come out, he said it should have been out by
allegedly
now.
Allegedly, my publisher says it'll be June the 1st, that's what it says, but I'm...
No, as a publisher,
you never
can't
know.
Picture that. You don't know.
You never know, particularly with the subject matter, particularly since I've published a lot of sensitive new material,
uh-huh.
including, for example, I spoke to a friend of President Kennedy's who was involved in the transportation of the president in 1961-62 to Tyndall Air Force Base in Florida to see alien bodies. I've got that story.
Mm.
The first time that story has come out, as a matter of fact.
No, you don't hear about that.
It was leaked to me, and I've even included a name.
You hear about Eisenhower and... Carter, but you never hear about Kennedy being involved in anything like that.
No.
Hmm. But this will be a regular paperback in the States then. When
yes, it's slightly out. Normal, the sort of trade paperback they call it.
And I have he has
like
the book in front of me, it was here, and it is a big book.
It is a big book. It is, and there are a lot of new top secret documents that I've reproduced. And
looks like it's, what, about 500-600 pages?
No, it's about 460, something like that. And
but it'll be bigger whenever it goes in. That's what I'm talking about,
yes.
About the blacking out of
that's
the documents.
That's right, but I've got top secret documents reproduced, which give a lot more information, including the famous National Security Agency one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's all blacked out completely, and now they've declassified a lot of it, and it's published.
Well, but this book, whenever it is reduced down to the regular size we sell in the States, it's going to be well over 500 pages, I'll bet, unless you're going to use a very small
print. I hope not, because I spent 6 weeks on the index,
so
it would need to be read.
Tell somebody else to update the index,
yeah,
then. You don't want to do that.
I've got extraordinary materials in this book, absolutely extraordinary. You know, like the two airliners coming into Dublin Airport in 2004 in January,
uh-huh.
were harassed by flying triangles. And this was observed by the planes in the landing pattern behind, even from 5-6 miles away. Large, triangular craft. This was at night. A violet color it was.
Yeah.
It had a strobe flashing on it, and it was harassing the plane in front, and it caused the outside air temperature to go up to 164 degrees Celsius.
Wow.
It damaged the plane. The plane couldn't, the air brakes were inoperable. The plane was all found to be dented when it did land. It landed safely in the end. People were, and this happened similar, not quite as drastic as that. 2 hours later, that same night, again observed by other pilots.
Well, now, one thing I do want to ask you, though, I just heard within Newsweek, it was just a one-liner, that France has now released all of their documents on UFOs. They said thousands of pages.
Here's the thing, you know, in the beginning, the sort of peg is that for the first time a government puts its UFO documents online. Nonsense. The Americans have been putting UFO documents online for years.
Okay.
Millions of pages.
All it said was, you know, thousands of pages.
France is not the first.
Okay.
It is the governments, like the sort of civil servants, UFO department, they have released nearly all their records, thousands of pages online. There'll be some very interesting things there, but believe me, Dolores, the French military and intelligence are withholding many, many more documents, which
it's
will
the,
not
be
put on.
It's the same as the ones you're looking at there, where everything is blacked out. They aren't going to tell you everything.
No.
They're going to withhold a lot of
course.
Things.
Of course.
But I saw that, and I was just wondering how much is going to be in there that's going to be of importance.
An awful lot. I mean, for example, the British Ministry of Defence released a 464-page plus document on UFOs called Project Condyne, and that was only written in the report was only written in the year 2000. I just got one sample from it, classified UK's eyes, secret UK eyes only. So that's interesting that the British Ministry of Defence released. I mean, the whole thing is available online, 465.
I was talking to Lou about it, and he said, They went online. Of course, since everything's in French, you got to know French before you can see the documents, too.
Yeah, so the Brits do it. The Brazilian government has released some documents. Certainly the Spanish, quite a long time ago, released top-secret Air Force files on UFOs.
Okay. Before we run out of time, too, I want you... The book is Need to Know. This is the new Timothy Good book, and you said it'll be released by June the 1st with Pegasus Publishing.
That's right.
And it'll be on www.pegasus.com.
Pegasus Books.
PegasusBooks.com.
And I think it's $16.99.
Okay, it'll obviously be with Amazon, too. Probably.
It'll obviously be with Amazon, probably for half price.
Well, usually they mark it down. But if someone wants to get a hold of you, how do you want them to contact you?
Well, I do have a website.
So tell them about the website.
Which is timothygood.co.uk.
And your name is G-O-O-D.
G-O-O-D,
yeah,
that's
Timothy,
right.
It's all together, timothygood.co.uk. And because you're in England.
That's right,
okay.
Yeah.
And can they communicate with you on that?
Well,
site?
To be honest, I don't have an email because I tried having an email and I was so inundated. Oh. I couldn't do anything. It really cut, and I just, that's the end of it. So if someone has anything really important to say, and if they're really interested in me finding it out, the best way is to write to the address I've given there, a care of address,
okay,
which is there on my website.
To me, the snail mail, we call it,
Yeah, I
don't have time to answer it anymore at all. You know, the letters that come in. The emails, I try to answer the ones that I think are the most important, but people don't realize they get upset because we don't answer immediately everything they send us.
It's impossible.
If we can't. They don't realize how much we get in one day.
Right.
And I try to pick out the ones that I think are the most important, but I still have emails, but I know what you're talking about. It gets to be an overload.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way they can communicate with you on your website.
No.
You don't want them to go that way. And no telephone number. You definitely don't want that.
No.
So it'll just be if they went right to you through
There's an address there on the website.
In your book, on the website.
My address in the UK, yeah.
There is an address to Timothy Good on his website in England if they want to write to you. But don't hold your breath about getting an answer.
Well, I don't have problems with letters. It's a lot of emails. I still can't answer them all.
Let me call the snail mail. I have problems with that because I just don't have time. I've got stacks of it.
Mm-hmm.
And if I tell people, don't be insulted. They just don't realize the amount of work we have the amount of contact we have. And people don't realize that.
Right.
We don't sit home waiting for somebody to write to us, that's for sure. Okay, we're coming down to the time to stop because we started a little later because they were trying to make this contact. But is there anything else you want to say before we sign off?
No, except that if people will write to me, you know, I will help them as much as I possibly can and put them in touch with whatever. But don't expect a terribly long letter. It's just not possible.
No, it's not. We can't do it. Okay, well then, I think that's everything tonight. And Timothy, I want to thank you for being on the show.
It's been a great pleasure.
I really respect your work and what you're doing.
Bless you. Thank you, Dolores.
Okay. And okay, then I think that's everything tonight. And good night, everybody.
Good night.